from eating boiled vegetables and masala-less curries in the Mahatma's ashram, to drinking beer in Karnataka and discovering the true secret of tandoori chicken in Chandigarh, The Great Indian Food Trip by Zakoya is a culinary adventure like you've never seen before. Welcome to Afterwards. I'm Samant Subramanian. I'm a writer and journalist in London. And I'm joined on the podcast today by Zakoya, a Swedish novelist, rock musician, and a food and travel writer. His new book, The Great Indian Food Trip, is such an entertaining, erudite adventure of eating and drinking and traveling through India, representing how Zak has come to understand the Indian subcontinent, which has now been his home for 30 years. Zak, you open in this miraculous, bizarre situation in which the world is, which is basically the pandemic, when no one can travel, and you are sitting there in Bangalore as a travel writer, wondering if travel itself, as we know it, is in danger of disappearing. And so I read the book as a love letter, perhaps, to other things that are in danger of disappearing, which is a kind of travel, the kind of travel you did 30 years ago when you first came to India, without Google Maps and a phone and Google reviews, you know, a more old-fashioned kind of travel. And throughout these chapters, I see these little kind of elegies to ways of being, you know, the ways in which you would drink beer in particular bars in Bangalore, like Sarovara on Lavelle Road, you know, these ghost mansions and abandoned mines in Kolar. Just everything is sort of a really elegant tribute to an earlier way of being. And I just, maybe we could start with this one big idea of whether I'm reading this right and what prompted you to write this love letter to the past.
Yeah, I think you're quite correct. On some level, of course, the pandemic played a role in writing this book, because as a travel writer, when the pandemic hit, it was just like you can't move forward. So I had to kind of look backwards and see, was there any meaning to my writing? And so this book is a kind of a putting together the manifesto, like, which is about, as an immigrant to India, like when you come to India, or as a tourist to India, as I initially was, and then later I became an immigrant, you try to understand a different country in some way. And for me, I think food became the best way to understand the whole complexity of Indian society. Because if you learn to understand the various different Indian cuisines, you will get like an idea about the complexity of India as a country on the whole. And then the food culture today is changing so fast here. So when I thought of this idea of writing a book about traveling around and sampling food in various parts of India and entering the local culture through the food, for example, when I travel in Tamil Nadu, I went to some places which were not like exactly food destinations. Like a place like Tirupur, which is in an area of Tamil Nadu called Kongu Nadu. And Tirupur is known as the most uninteresting tourist destination of all of India. But it's a very important industrial hub in textile terms. And travel writers have generally never gone there. But I thought I'll stop over there and see what happens. And then I found some restaurant that was serving food that was like very authentic, like very, and very different from the usual Indian food that you get in Indian restaurants all over the world. They had different cooking methods, and that kind of thing, when you come to a place like that, it's sort of a bit of mind-blowing when you're a travel writer and a historian or wannabe historian or whatever I am. And you're in a place and you feel that, oh, those were the great experiences. And then, of course, I look at like all the writers who have been traveling in India when India was a British territory, and they wrote accounts of their encounters with restaurants in those days, which is like 100 years back. But that's also like part of my book, in a sense of trying to look at like what restaurants, or like where did these travelers go and eat 100 years ago or 200 years ago. I tried both to look at like geographically across all of India and then in depth through like past into history of the particular places, like where was the first tandoori chicken born in global history, for example.
I mean, it's really interesting that you bring up tandoori chicken, because the example that you give of tandoori chicken in the book is such a perfect case study of how slippery the notion of authenticity is. So, you know, for example, the chicken itself, for starters, the chicken, the bird chicken, is a native Indian bird that then went westward. The tandoor, or the clay oven sunk into the ground in which this tandoori chicken is cooked, that was something that was initially seen in the Middle East, in Mesopotamia, and then came eastwards. I think you say that it was called Timuru, and at some point that word changed into tandoor. And then the tandoori chicken itself, and the idea of cooking the chicken in a tandoor, was born in and around Peshawar in what is now Pakistan, but wasn't really a common dish in Delhi, which is, you know, what one might think of as the world capital of tandoori chicken today. And so this notion of what is authentic to a place and where things come from and what we think of as this marriage of history and food is really interesting. And I think there's like a, I mean, I don't know what kind of historical or political lessons we can draw from that, but I'd be eager to hear your view about this so-called slippery notion of the authentic cuisine.
Like the chicken story is very fascinating, first of all. So like it started as a jungle fowl in somewhere in Bengal or Bangladesh, or basically in that upper Bay of Bengal area. Then it became like a Harappan thing that was worshipped. And then around 700 BC, it turned up in the Mediterranean, where you can see it like painted on Greek vases, like where they have these banquets and drink wine and there'll be chickens on those. And then around the year zero, it comes to Britain, which has nothing to do with, you know, counting time from the year zero, actually. But it's still like in Northern European terms, it's a fairly new food item. It's only 2,000 years old, which is actually quite old. But then if you look at American terms, chicken only came to America with Columbus, who went there, brought chicken, and brought back potatoes and tomatoes and chilies and some other things. So, I mean, now, like, I believe Kentucky Fried Chicken is like 1/3 of all the chickens in the world are Kentucky Fried. And thing about the authenticity, like you can argue that Kentucky Fried Chicken is not an authentic American dish because it came from us, from India to there. But then you can also argue like masala dosa, which is like a lot of people feel masala dosa is ought to be named as the Indian national dish. And masala dosa is actually a world famous dish. It's been on top list around the world as, you know, one of the 10 foods you should try before you die, and you know, all that, those kind of lists. But you think about masala dosa, largely made of potato and some onion and some spices, mustard seeds and various things. In India, potatoes came first in the 1800s. So the quintessential food that is beloved by everybody, if you go to India, you can't live without having a masala dosa. Without potatoes, what is a masala dosa? So it's the most authentic dish on one level. And then on the other level, it's a bit like it would not have been possible without this cultural exchange of food between different countries in the world.
Zach, as a matter of logistics, I mean, the book itself is a seamless narrative of chapters. You know, you could read the whole thing and imagine that you set out one day, started in Bangalore, went to Mysore, and didn't come back until about 10 months later. But I imagine this must have been journeys undertaken over many months, if not years. So tell me a little bit about the time period over which these trips were taken.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Actually, on some level, the book spans more than 30 years, or like my whole existence in India on some level. But when I was looking at the material and trying to kind of figure out this book in a technical sense, how to make it interesting to readers, I didn't want to do like, you know, just like a collection of essays. So I was thinking like how to put my experiences into a form that would be interesting. So I started putting it together in that it makes sense geographically. So like some of the places where I write about, I actually went there like maybe 3 times or 4 times or 10 times, but I condense it into one visit. Because I'm also a novelist part-time, like half of my books are novels. So I've taken those liberties of cutting out that I went from there to there, there to there, there to there, there to there, and instead try to make it into like a beautiful journey through the form of culinary landscape exploration. So as a book, it's not really about just somebody drifting around and spending a few days here and there, but generally it's about getting deep into these places. I thought it's better to make it look at like a journey that somebody who reads the book could also take. Like they could just buy the book and follow the track and have all these amazing food experiences. Also, it's not just about food experience, but also cultural, like literary experiences. And like I often say that when people ask me like, oh, what do you think about Indian food? I try to tell them, let's not talk about Indian food. Let's talk about the foods of India. And to me, that's a very important point because Indian food is very easily reduced. Like in my original home country, Sweden, if you go to an Indian restaurant, it's a tandoori chicken and palak paneer. I mean, it's a very particular kind of Indian food from a particular part of India, which does great food. But when you actually explore India and see it as a culinary geography, you realize that there's so many things within Indian food that you would not even think that it's Indian food unless you experience it firsthand. So, and even if you take like a classic Indian dish like biryani, in India, you'll easily have 100 different versions of biryani. And likewise, if you take something like samosa, you have a different samosa in Delhi, in Kolkata and those parts, they call it singara. And in South India, again, it'll be a bit different. So I was trying to break that stereotype of Indian food being just Indian food. But like, if you think about Indian food, you have to think in terms of like, okay, European food. So you can't compare like Swedish food to Italian food. So like your fish and chips, it won't be anything like the seafood you get in Greece.
You know, when I was trying to imagine your average day when you were traveling in these parts, a travel writer has to go deep and do a lot of work and a lot of legwork and a lot of research, but someone has to make the entire process on the page seem quite casual and unforced. And so I was trying to imagine sort of what your average day would have been like. And for me, I remember when I was traveling to research Following Fish, the biggest stress point for me every morning was, where would I eat over the coming 24 hours or the coming 12 hours? You know, where would I eat 2 lunches? Where would I eat dinner? Where else would I kind of peek into to see what they had to offer? Because really, you want to kind of find the sweet spot of a restaurant that is properly local, reflects something larger, is, insofar as the word means anything, authentic, and yet something that people can access. And so, you know, a lot of time would be spent talking to people in the town that I went to about places they like to eat or where they would recommend that I go visit and eat. And so I wonder, sort of, how did you pick the places that you eventually ate lunches and dinners and breakfasts at? What was the process of selection for you?
I think like pretty much the same way that you did. I do a lot of research beforehand. I make like huge short lists and then I look at different people's opinions. Also, I try to kind of look at what are the old places. So it's not necessarily like what is trendy or happening in a particular city at a particular time, because that's usually not really interesting to me. So I look at like the heritage aspect of eating, and then I talk with the local people and ask them like, what would you suggest is a good place to eat, or where do you like to go and eat? And then there's also this thing like follow the alcohol trail. In many towns, like in Bangalore where I live, if you look at which are the best pubs, usually the best pubs, because Bangalore is known as the pub capital of the India or pub capital of Karnataka or pub capital of Bangalore. And if you find the most popular pubs, they will usually have the best food. And likewise, if you go, like when I travel in Tamil Nadu, they have this very interesting concept of if you go to a bar of a certain price class, not like a luxury bar and not like a extremely cheap bar, but some mid-range, slightly dingy bar, if you order one beer, they'll give you some 6-7 side dishes, a little bit of chicken curry, a little bit of veg curry, all kinds of vegetables and nuts and things to eat. So you get like a spread of the local favorite dishes on your table just for the price of a beer, which is very much like the concept of like meze and tapas in the Mediterranean countries, but this is a more like an indigenous thing here. So like one of my greatest food discoveries in the book, which I document in the book, was actually like I met some fellows on a train who were from Kerala. And we were talking about food and they said that, oh, if you like food, you should go to Talasari and have Kalumakai. I made note, I didn't know what they were talking about, but Talasari, Kalumakai. And then as soon as possible, I kind of booked myself a journey by train or bus to Talasari. And then I went to a restaurant or a bar. I mean, the fellow said that you have to have Kalumakai in a bar because it won't be good in a restaurant. I went to a restaurant. I ordered, asked them to do Kalumakai. They said, no, we don't do that. I said like, okay, but if I book it, will you do it? They said, yes. And then I went to some bar to wait out the time and asked, like, do you have Kalumakai? And then it immediately came within 5 minutes. Wonderful, fresh. So Kalumakai is basically mussels, which is very popular in a Talasari, Mahe area of Kerala. And it's usually had with beer as a snack. So it's a very Belgian thing, if you think about it. Like the Belgians have the best beers in Europe and the best mussels in Europe. So likewise, this Talasari area had best mussel beer combination culture.
I want to wrap this up really quickly with one big final question for you. But I also want to read this lovely quote that Pico Iyer gives you towards the end, which is so apt for travel writers and travel writing and the paradox of travel writing. You know, he says, I gather that you meet him in Bhutan and he talks about how Thimphu, the capital of Bhutan, has changed since he first started going there. And then his quote reads, I thought, well, it's less idyllic seeming for me than it was, but development probably means a richer and happier life for people here. We visitors have to be careful about the wishes we project, the fact that we want places to remain beautiful for our camera lenses. And that, I think, is such a, of course, Pico is the arch druid of travel writers, and it is so in character for him to drop a nugget on you like that. But I think it's such a great encapsulation of what travel writers look for, what they sometimes fail to find, what they might be disappointed by, and what they shouldn't be disappointed by. The fact that the world moves and progresses should not be something that disappoints a travel writer because things are not set in stone or frozen in amber or frozen in aspic. Zach, I have one final question for you. We finish every show here by asking our guests about one source or text, whether it's a movie or a book or anything else that influenced this book of yours. What was yours? What was your influential source or text?
This is a very difficult question because there's been so many influential texts, and the books that have influenced these books is actually your book, Following Fish, which has that idea of culinary geography at its core. And then there's, even before that, there's a fascinating book that was published in around 1997, which was called Travels with the Fish by an Indian author called C.Y. Gopinath. Wrote this absolutely marvelous and really amazing book where he talks about various places he travels to. And then somehow he managed to kind of squeeze in a few cooking recipes at the end of each chapter of wherever he goes to. And it's a largely unknown book. But I read it like when it came out around that time in late 1990s. And it's so fascinating by this idea of you write a chapter about going to some place and then you share your recipes or something. And a sort of irreverence to the travel writing genre, which, like, if you look at hardcore travel writing, it's a bit like you have to be some William Dalrymple or some goes through some desert with your camels and your servants and your retinue and everything. And you discover some Maharaja's palace where you're giving a luxury massage. And this C.Y. Gopinath's travel writing, as well as your own travel writing, Samat, it's a bit like you're just coming to some place and trying to figure out, like, oh, what am I seeing here? How do I understand this? And then you put together what makes sense to you. So the best travel writing is on that level to me.
I think this book by C.Y. Gopinath as a influence on the Great Indian Food Trip, that's a pretty good answer. As is, of course, the tribute to Pico Iyer, who is every travel writer's influence. It's a great way to end, and I hope, Zach, that your palate and your legs continue to take you to strange and wonderful places where you try to figure out what to eat for lunch and dinner and tell us about them. It's been such a fantastic experience to talk to you about this and to read The Great Indian Food Trip. For our listeners, you can buy a copy of The Great Indian Food Trip from Hearst Publishers' website. Thank you to Zach Oyer once again for taking part in this episode. Afterwards is produced by George McDonough. For more, follow Hearst on Twitter at Hearst Publishers and follow me on Samanth_S on Twitter. And to get news on the latest Hearst books, subscribe to their email updates at hearstpublishers.com. I'm Samanth Subramanian. Thank you for listening.